Olympic medalist and Tour de France podium finisher coach Bobby Julich and Outskirts visionary Gus Morton invite you to put your socks on. Winning and losing, training and racing, pro, not pro. All of it comes down to understanding what works and what doesn't. From insightful analysis into our sport's most iconic races and racers to entertaining, educational, and actionable advice, Fizzo is an illuminating deep dive into the art and science of bike racing. Be prepared to put your socks on.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Put Your Socks On. My name is Bobby Julich, and as always, I'm here with Gus Morton. How are you doing today, Gus?
Bobby, I'm very well. Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We have an awesome show today. If you guys were privileged enough to watch a little bit of it, it was fast as hell out there. Team time trial, one of the more rare disciplines in the pro cycling. So it was nice to see it on display. The Tour de France, man, it's all time. Today's stage, before we get into the minutia, let's talk top line details. I was in Brussels again, did a little loop from the Palais Royal to the Atomium, which was a rather beautiful building. If you have a moment, take a second to Google it. 27.6 Ks, fast stage. Brussels, it's part of Flanders, but they speak French, not Flemish. It was a flat stage. Merckx was there. Apparently Merckx was actually blessed by the Pope during one of his visits to Brussels in the 90s. So there you go, Eddie Merckx, a true superstar. Jean-Claude Van Damme, the muscles from Brussels as well. So another piece of trivia there for you guys. Before we move on, Bobby, I believe you've got a message from our sponsor.
Yeah, but before we move into that, I need a little bit more information about your experience in Belgium. So, okay, chocolate, beer, or Fritz? How would you rate those as the things that you actually eat or look forward to when you visit Belgium?
Oh, dude, good question. this is real talk right now. I don't like Belgian beer that much. Oh. Just going to say it. I knew it's sacrilegious, right? Like people get fired up and I'm like, yeah, I could take it or leave it. I'm going to go with Fritz.
Fritz. Okay.
What about you?
No, I'm a Belgian beer sort of guy. So I would go beer, Fritz, and then chocolate is my final one. But those are a three must consume when you're in Belgium.
Did you race much in Belgium?
You know, not so much. Our service course was based up there when I was with Motorola. Got to go out to dinner with Eddie Merckx and his family.
Really?
Back, I think, the first year, like 1995. Yeah, I hate to admit this, but I got into cycling so late, I didn't really know who Eddie Merckx was. Of course, I heard the name and heard the legend, but like I didn't have that real fanboy sort of mentality around him. But he is the most coolest, calmest guy right in the middle of a restaurant. You know, obviously he's a superstar and people would come up to him and ask for, you know, an autograph because back then we didn't have, you know, cell phone cameras as at all. And he was just so nice to everybody. I was really impressed with that. But yeah, it was, Brussels is an amazing town. Have you ever actually been to the Atomium?
No, I haven't actually. I can't even remember if I've been to Brussels or not.
Oh, yeah. If you can't remember, that means you haven't been there because it's pretty freaking awesome. Yeah. But yeah, that Atomium thing actually was made for the 1958 World's Fair. And obviously, it's a Adams sort of look to it, right? So yeah, I just wanted to look at it a little bit more and detail and saw that it was 9 atoms in a unit cell of an iron crystal magnified 165 billion times.
Professor Bobby Julich, man, you've been doing your research, Bobby.
No, it's one of those things that you look at, but it took until today for me to actually find out exactly what it was. But can you imagine? Yeah. So I guess all those little bulbs, you can like walk in there and those little side panels are ways to access them. And there's evidently this beautiful restaurant on the top with a panoramic view of Brussels. So next year or in the future, when we're live, we definitely have to do our podcast from that panoramic restaurant up on top of the Otonium. That would be fun.
100%. Shall we get into today's stage? But before that, Bobby, as I said, you've got a little information from our sponsor.
Yeah, Road Idea is our sponsor this year. They're doing this really great trivia quiz question sort of thing. So for today's daily dose of your Road ID Tour trivia, to play, head over to roadid.com/TDF. And today's question is, what was the nickname of the first Tour de France champion, Maurice Guérin? Do you have any idea there?
No. Yeah.
I'm glad we have the answer. I'm glad we have the answer sheet. Yeah, go to roadid.com/Tour de France to answer this question and score a chance to win today's prize, which is a tax bike trainer. I mean, there's some real prizes at this in this competition, isn't there, Gus? We got some good stuff here.
That's a legit hookup there. Not only do you have to remember to put your socks on tomorrow, but you have to remember to get your daily dose. The Road ID competition, get over there, get the trivia, and get yourself the trainer. Bobby, today's stage, fill me in.
Well, today's stage isn't just the actual stage itself. It's the full day, right? Like, guys are getting out there. They had the course open for about an hour, so everyone was out there reconning it. It's a very stressful day for only 27.6 kilometers. There's no doubt about that. And on the map, it looked like it was really tricky to get from the Palais Royal over to the Otonium and then back to the Palais Royal. So it was a pretty stressful day for everyone. The course was pretty straightforward, a little bit of rolling up and down, you know, a couple turns here and there until you got into the final, which I always found pretty tricky. You know, you got these guys absolutely on their limit. And all of a sudden you throw a couple chicanes at them, like right at the end. It was a recipe for disaster. I only saw one crash, but I was actually surprised to not see anything more. But yeah, team Ineos just took it right out of the box, you know, just gripped it and ripped it and said, hey, you know, beat us if you can. And one after another, they were getting close, very, very close, but it took until the last team to go to actually beat them. And I must say they beat them quite handedly. So when you lose a team time trial, like we saw that De Koninck Quickstep came in less than a second down, I was like, ooh, that's a tough one to take. I've been in that situation one time in the Tour de France where we actually lost by 1 second, but I've also been in team time trials that we've won by less than a second. So I can't really complain, but I was kind of feeling a little bit knowing that, you know, this is a big event for the equipment sponsors, right? This is a way of saying, absolutely, hey, we have the fastest wheels, we have the fastest bikes, we have the fastest skin suits, helmets, et cetera, et cetera. This is really a showcase for the sponsors even more than the team and the riders themselves.
Like, as you said, you know, there was Quickstep less than a second down. We had Alpecin up there. We had Sunweb up there. And, you know, so like it was tight. They're all within a handful of seconds. And then Jumbo-Visma just start and we're 14 seconds up. And then I think they were, what, like 20 seconds up at the finish? Crushed it, like two from two, outstanding start. And way too, you know, we talked a little bit yesterday about, like, you know, setting out your intention at the start of the race. And these guys have set their intention out. They're not here to fuck about. They're here to win this race. And I mean, yeah, 100% record so far. Bobby, I wanted to ask you a question because I don't think like a lot of people realize this, and it's like the teams go out and recon the stage beforehand, but the logistics of, as you just said, like you've got to recon, you've got to eat, you've got to get from the finish back to the start, you've got to do your warm up, you know, and that's all like the specific times that you're allowed to pre-ride the course. What's that like? And what's like a bit of the, can you give like a bit of the preparation rundown that these riders would probably do prior to the race?
Yeah, it's really tricky because you're basically operating from your truck or your bus all day long, because normally you don't have a hotel right there on the course. So you're getting up pretty early, you're eating a normal breakfast at the hotel, but then it's game on. You know, you got to get to the start. Everyone's nervous. You know, it is a big day. The mechanics and the support actually have to be spot on. They have to make sure that they have all the equipment ready, all the food ready, because you're going to be eating in the bus. You want to get that fueling schedule down correctly. And sometimes, and this is why I thought that maybe Team Ineos had a little bit of an advantage, was, you know, they were able to do the recon, come back to the bus, have a little snack, and do a short warm up, and then boom, they were out on the course. But imagine some of those teams that went and did the recon, then had to hang out in their bus for 2 hours at the start, 3 hours maybe, and then kind of re-warm up again.
Yes, obviously down in between.
So the logistical person on that day and the directors, the work that the directors and the middle management and the coaches have to come up with is amazing. So you're just trying to keep the riders as calm as possible. You know you're going to be in a cramped space. There's going to be many more people in that bus compared to, say, an individual time trial. I mean, at least mm-hmm. at the same time. And that warm-up area is crucial. You want to keep that, you know, you don't want to put up the Great Wall of China, but you want to have a little bit of space so the riders can feel that as soon as I step out of the bus, I don't have 10 cameras in my face. So setting up that, what I call the pit, is very, very important. And some of the cool things that have been around for a while and I saw on TV again that are still out there are just those little tricks in that pit. You know, obviously you have the turbo trainer, you have the coach running the warm-up schedule, all the guys are there warming up on their bikes. But then you have those little tricks like the misting fan, you know, that lowers the ambient temperature a little bit, not just like where it's hitting you with water, you have to pour water over your head, but it's got a little mister that kind of throws water into the fan and then kind of just gives you that nice refreshing little mist. Then you saw the ice vest. Yeah, then you saw the ice vest. And this is all what the coaches and the performance people determine is going to give their riders an advantage moving forward. And yeah, the warm-up is crucial. There's no doubt about that. But in a team time trial in the Tour de France, there's the bike check that you always have to go through. And instead of just going and checking your bike, you got to leave enough time to check 8 people's bikes. Of course, the mechanics went there and pre-checked them and made sure that everything was right. But there's always that kind of extra stand around time, which you wouldn't normally have before an individual time trial.
There's always that fear too, right? Because, like, you know, it's the Tour de France, as we saw, I mean, between second and third, like, there's nothing in it. And so you want those bars as long as they can possibly be. You know, you want to make sure that you're as low in the front as you can be, or, you know, as far forward in front of the bracket as you can be. So, like, you're on the edge. It's millimeter perfect, right? And so there's always that fear that the UCI's jig doesn't match up to the team's jig.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started on that UCI jig. We've seen some pretty ghetto rigs show up at races before. And then yes. They say that it's not legal. And then the mechanic who has a lot of experience is like, wait a second, but the ground isn't level. And they're like, we forgot to do that. Like, so they just put the fear of God in you that you have to cut your bars down by a centimeter. And as soon as they level it out, they're like, oh, no, Saba, it's good. It's fine. So yeah. The mechanics have a lot of pressure on them. The staff do as well. The riders, you know, they have to deal with it in their own way, but they're kind of, you know, a little bit secluded from that sort of stuff because it is the Tour de France. So there's always new equipment coming out. So you got to be a little bit careful with that. You know, obviously you want to test that sort of stuff at training camps and prior to the race, but there's always that one thing that somebody brings into the tour, like, hey, this is brand new, let's use this, which is, oh man, that's the red flags go up. You know?
Yeah, you know, it works the opposite way to the last stuff. Before we move on and hear from our super fan, I wanted to just ask you real quick, because there was as is with anything that Ineos does, people believe that there's no such, you know, it's all with intent. They were first off today. Talk about, like, do you want to just quickly touch on, like, I mean, they had to sit in the hot seat the entire day, you know, for no cigar. Do you reckon they intended to start first? Do you think they kind of purposely sandbagged the finish or what?
No way. You never want to start first. Especially when the start order is determined by the first three guys. So like the team GC classification at the stage, there's no way that you could actually plan that. There's, you know, 190 guys out there, and, you know, you definitely wouldn't want to purposely be in the back because then you're in jeopardy of taking a gap. So that was just, that crash happened. They were all looking after Garrett and Bernal. They knew that they were inside that 3K limit, so they didn't really have to rush to the line. And that's just the way the cookie crumbled for them today. That being said, it perhaps was a little bit of an advantage to just go out there and just lay down the law and say, here we go. This is all we can do. And it was really great to see that the weather conditions stayed exactly the same from when they went compared to when Jumbo Visma went. But there's one X factor that you cannot calculate in any sort of pre-race plan. And that's the emotion and the motivation, the morale that a team has when they have the yellow jersey on. It is from firsthand experience back in 2001, when I was on Team Credit Agricole, we had Stuart O'Grady in the yellow jersey. And we were a smaller French team compared to the powerhouses of U.S. Postal, ONCE, et cetera, et cetera. And we started last. And from the first time check, we were 8 seconds up. Second time check, we were 30 seconds up. Then U.S. Postal, I believe, had a crash, and we wound up winning by, I think, a minute or over a minute. And it was just a phenomenal feeling to look back and see your brothers, your buddies, your teammates, and then that guy in the yellow jersey. It just gave you that extra little bit. So those guys are riding on a high, that's for sure. But that definitely had a little bit to do with it. So
yeah, they rode out of their skin today. I mean, like you saw George Bennett, you know, at the end there, I think it was Groenewegen or maybe someone was talking about how George wasn't really meant to last that long. But he was still there and he was still like pulling really strong turns and they'd kind of planned for him to be gone. But, you know, the power of the yellow jersey. So well done to them. We got the super fan waiting in the wings. Shall we move on to chat to him?
Be prepared. It's time for super fan.
Hey, we're here. All right, guys. Tunisin, I love seeing that man in yellow. What a ride. What a ride by Jumbo Visma. This proves you got to bring your meat sack to the tour if you want to compete early on for that GC. Let's see here. What's my question for Bobby? Bobby, what's it like going into the team time trial as a TT specialist? Are you looking forward to showing off a little bit for your teammates? Is there a little more pressure on you to perform since your weaker teammates are relying on you for longer turns? Talk about how the feelings are different from an individual time trial. Put me in the mindset of one of these specialists because it's something most of us regular dudes can't even fathom.
Super fan.
Good question.
Very good question. And everybody listening has to remember one thing about a team time trial. And the first thing that you have to do is check your ego at the door. If you're one of those guys that want to prove to yourself or your teammates or the guys following in the car that you're stronger, you know what? Do that in the last half of the race. But often we see a lot of nervous people out there taking pulls that are way too long, way too strong. So as a specialist, I think that I had a little bit of an advantage because I was less nervous. I knew that I had the physiology that would allow me to perform quite well. And luckily, I was always one of the best or one of the best guys in the team time trial. So, yes, it's very important to go in there with a mindset that, hey, I'm not here to prove anything to anybody. I'm here to, you know, take steady pulls. You know, I can increase the length of my pull later in the race when I'm confident that, you know, I maybe have to make up for one of my teammates or that I'm feeling really good. But that's why the start and the person that takes the start is so critical. And I was paying attention to which team members were taking the start first from their teams today. And it was the guys with mega experience. And, you know, Garrett Thomas, winner of the Tour de France, Olympic champion on the track in the team pursuit. Guess who was the guy that was taking off his team off the start ramp? It was him. Who else better to do something like that? Because you have to get up to speed. but you also got to make sure that you don't put people in the red right away. And with the nerves going on at the start line, that's very, very easy to do. So for me, definitely it's a team event. And obviously it changed a little bit from when we used to have 9 people, you had to have 5 people cross the line. Now that it's 8 member teams, there's only 4 people that have to cross the line. But it is a team effort. It is not an individual effort. And I've seen teams blow up sky high because there's that one guy that maybe tries to be a little bit too ego in his pulls or his turns throughout the race.
Have you ever been hooped, Bobby? Have you ever been like, I'm on today, like it's my job, I'm the TT specialist, and then you get in there and you're like, oh, this is not good. Have you ever had that experience?
Luckily not. I'd say, like I said, I was always quite proficient at the team time trial, but I do remember the team time trial that was probably the most difficult for me because I was put behind Fabian Cancellara. And Fabian is not only one of the strongest individual time trialists and Olympic champion, but he is so freaking aero that it's very difficult. Like you're sitting second wheel and you feel like you're already on the front, and then he swings off and you feel like you have to do a double pull. That was Tour of Germany in 2008 that I was behind him, and I was really like about ready to pull the plug and say, okay, guys, come around me. Because it was actually on a descent, and I'm like, I can't hold this guy's wheel. Like I'm holding up the team. So I kind of pulled out a line. And when I turned around to look, all my teammates were probably another 100 meters, 50 to 100 meters behind us. So I wasn't that bad, but riding behind Fabian is a big, big ask of anyone. And it's just part of the thing that you have to think about when you're looking at the order of the team time trial. Like I was looking at Movistar today. Who the heck would want to be behind Nairo Quintana? There's no draft whatsoever there. And, you know, at least with Fabian, you know that he's going to pull strong. But with Nairo, man, that's a tough place to be.
So how is the order determined ahead of time? I mean, is it based on that, on who sits more aerodynamically? Is it based on who's going to be taking longer pulls? I mean, it's got to be different for every team. But what are your thoughts on how they place everybody?
Super fan.
Yeah, size has something to do with it for sure. But you really want to look at your rider's strengths and weaknesses. And I always believed in putting in a power line, which is having, say, you have 5 of your 8 guys that are really, really good at time trials or really good at team time trials. I like to put those 5 guys together. I like to put those guys together and really develop that power line. And the other 2 or 3 guys or 4 guys, regardless of the size of the team, they kind of just came through and pulled off. You know, it may be somebody that you just don't really know how they're going to be. But once you hit halfway, you know, things can, you know, that order that you have may be all scattered all over the place because guys could take, maybe sit on the back for a while and then jump in. But yeah, I think you have to find that aerodynamic benefit from getting behind, putting your strong guys together, and then also taking into account the fact that there's going to be a few guys that have to take those shorter, quicker pulls. But determining the line is great at the start, but could get messed up pretty quickly if there's something. So you have to be comfortable riding behind whomever. But when you don't have brakes because your hands are out on your extensions, that's a big ask sometimes.
Known knowns, known unknowns, unknown unknowns.
So Bobby, let's put together if you had to go to the Tour de France and you just built a team to win the team time trial, who are your 8? Who's your 8 power line? Who are your 8 guys you'd take? Obviously Fabian would be up there.
Super fan.
Yeah.
No, Fabian's too aero.
Fabian's too aero, but you always want Fabian. Fabian is the best, especially before the race. He's exciting. So I would have to go back to, because of course you want to pick teammates that you may have ridden with, right? So I would go back to the 2001 team. I would say Tor Hushovd, Jens Vogt, Stuart O'Grady, myself. Then I would switch to George Hincapie and for sure Fabian, and also David Zabriskie. Is that eight? I think that's eight.
Yeah, I think that's eight.
Yeah.
And that's a strong team. Some old timers in there.
That's a really strong team. That's
noticeable absence of my all-time TT favorite, Jan Ulrich, but you know, that's all right. I guess he could just ride it by himself and he'd be fine.
Yeah, I've never done a team time trial with Jan Ulrich, so I wouldn't know, but I imagine he was quite good back in the day as well.
I guess this leads us all on to today's theme, which is aerodynamics, and specifically aerodynamics when it comes to the TTT. And I guess, like, you know, the super fans' questions, really good there. Answers, Bobby alluded to it. Like, aerodynamics are really important. Not only, like, you know, you made the point about Cancellara. Like, he was so aero that to sit behind him is annoying. And then ordering the team and all of that. How's, like, I want to sort of hear from you, like, how has aerodynamics and the importance of it changed since the beginning of your career to now, when we're looking at, you know, the shape of the derailleur and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's gone to a totally different level. I mean, those bikes are missiles now. The riders are missiles. You're thinking from everything from the skin suit, and I'll try to do this maybe in priority, in my opinion. I think the skin suit is the number one thing that you can really look at and improve, or that has been improved upon.
Really?
No doubt. Oh, man.
Why is that?
Well, back in the day, a skin suit was just a long sleeve Lycra jersey. It wasn't anything special. Now they've got dimples. They've got all sorts of different material that when you look at it under a microscope, you can really see the difference. It's not flapping in the wind. It is absolutely skin tight. So yeah, go up to your attic and pull out a skin suit that you had in 1988, like I have, compared to one of the skin suits you pull off of Team Ineos or Team Jumbo-Visma, and it'll be a night and day difference, especially on the cost, because those are not cheap. Then you look at the wheels. Like back in the day, I mean, remember guys doing time individual and maybe even team time trials with double discs. Like, you never see that anymore. The tires are a massive thing.
Dude, the double discs was sick, by the way. I just want to just highlight that. Bring back the double disc.
That was quite cool, especially.
Impossible to steer though. Holy shit.
Yeah, one of my favorite events ever was watching the team pursuit at the junior world championships or the Olympics, because, man, that just looks so rad. But yeah, a little bit impractical out there on the road, right? then yeah, the helmets have changed. You know, back in the day, guys would do team time trials and time trials without a helmet. Now you have not only a helmet, but the helmet has an integrated visor. And I'd be really interested to see. I was looking at the Bahrain Merida team today. It looked like they had a little place for, I don't know, the radio or maybe a camera on the back of it. It was like a little opaque kind of black hole.
I don't know what that is. Like, I thought that might have been like a spot you could attach like more of a, like another fin or something.
Okay. Maybe you're right. But
looking at that, fans, tell us, what is it?
Anyone? Everything with the equipment has gone to another level, but let's talk about the aerodynamic position of the rider, because when you actually add all these things together, you know, the bike, the wheels, the biggest issue that you're creating is your body. That's what's creating the CDA. That's what's creating the wind resistance. So I do feel that in the past, a lot of riders, a lot of biomechanics specialists were trying to get too aero. So it was really all the
affecting
way
forward. Affecting the rider's power and stuff.
Exactly. So all the way forward, all the way slammed down, totally different position that they normally ride in. And over the years, working with different biomechanical specialists, you start to see that aerodynamics is important, but if you can't put the power to the pedals, it's for naught. So you go into a wind tunnel, you put a guy in a crazy position, and you put him out on the road and he can't hold that position under power for more than 2K without having to stretch his back or his hamstrings are tight or, you know, he's cramping up. That you got it. So there is definitely that balance between being aero and being powerful. And, you know, lower is not always better when it comes to that. I've seen some crazy examples of raise, especially with bigger guys that are, you know, slammed all the way down and all the way forward, extension all the way to the max. Then you put them up and you bring them back and maybe even shorten their extension. And it totally changes their shoulders, because remember, the shoulders is one of the first things that's really creating drag, right? So yeah, exactly. If you could actually roll those shoulders forward instead of having them point out, you're going to have a lower CDA and thus go faster. But
and tell me how, like, all of this, so like, this is like, you know, this is all just the individual, right? And then, so you've got to think about that today, like that's times by eight, but then now it's also too, like, how those eight guys work together. So then it becomes like, how long are they spending on the front? Like, you know, what's the, so like, how's that then change again? Do they, you know, I remember hearing stories of riders changing their seating position, seat height and stuff for a team's time trial in order to like create a better draft for the rider that was behind them. Or so does that change as well? Like, do they approach a TTT completely differently again?
Well, I think in today's age, you can really geek out in the wind tunnel. You know, back in the day, it was one person in the wind tunnel. Now you can put in an entire team in the wind tunnel and you can stay there for days playing with different little options and changes and whatnot. But I really feel there's a better way to utilize your time than do something like that. Like, get the riders comfortable on their bikes, have them train in that position on that bike under some sort of pressure. I always tell my riders, and I always kind of had it in the back of my head as well, maybe it was coming from America where we did do a lot of time trials, was even if you're 100th place in GC, 45 minutes behind the lead, you have an opportunity to test your equipment, your position, and your condition out there on the road. So take it as if you were going for the yellow jersey, because one day you will be in that position where you have to defend a yellow jersey or maybe overtake the person that's leading so that you can win the race. And if you haven't done that work, if you haven't done that testing, if you haven't gotten your kind of protocol down pat, you're going to show up that day and you're going to be noticeably more nervous. And that's a big part of time trials and a huge part of team time trials is just your mental state that day. Because let's face it, team time trials, these guys, it's like riding in an echelon. So like, these guys do it every single day, but like, you throw a little pressure in there and a couple of questions like, oh, is my seat height too high or am I sitting too far back or too far forward? Those are things that you don't need to be thinking about when you're going 60 to 65K an hour behind seven guys going for a stage win in the tour like today.
Good advice. And I reckon that's something you can kind of take across the entire board, right? Is like, get the practicing where you can, because one day you'll find yourself in that position where you're about to win something. And if you're not ready for it, like you're not comfortable, then you might lose it. Before we move on, before we get onto tomorrow's stage, Bobby, what's your favorite piece of aero equipment throughout the ages?
Oh, that's an easy one. The thing that changed everything for everyone is the aero bar. You know, it was always cool to have a disc wheel. It was always cool to have maybe that Giro styrofoam helmet that Greg LeMond wore in the tour in 89, when he beat Fignon. Yep. But man, once you got that pair of aero bars, that changed everything. So for me, for sure, the aero bars, and especially now, you know, you got them, you know, 3D laser printed, you got the arm pads sculpted to your forearms, your personal forearms. So now I love to sit in a cockpit of one of those bikes that have been made for me. It'd be phenomenal.
Dude, I'm, you can have your laser 3D printing. I'm all about that homemade shit. And for me, it's Grand Abri, the washing machine bike. That's my favorite piece of aero equipment. That shit was ridiculous and crazy aero. Like, actually, it was. Like, your CDA is insane on that thing.
Oh, with the Superman position you're talking about.
No, not even the Superman. That one where he, like, lay on the handlebars.
Oh,
Superman's
yeah.
not that much more aero. At least his Superman. But the him where he, like, laid on the handlebars, that position, I don't even know what you call that. That shit was aero.
Didn't they call that the egg position or something like that?
Yeah, man.
And then I heard a story, and maybe the listeners can help us. I heard with the whole thing about, oh, he built this bike out of washing machine parts. I heard that it was actually just one washing machine, like spacer or like one tiny piece that he actually stole from a washing machine. It wasn't like he made this bike out of a washing machine, but I used to think like, oh my gosh, this guy made a bike out of a washing machine. He's a
same here. I was like, how the fuck did he make the tubes? I was like, where are those tubes in my washing machine?
You got all these kids like breaking apart their parents' washing machine, trying to make a totally aero bike out of it. And then they just come out totally disappointed. But
yeah, it was like the ball bearings or something. Yeah. Yeah. No, I heard that as well. I was a bit disappointed because I was like, man, where in the fuck did he get those tubes from? But anyway, with that, I reckon we've covered it. Let's move on to tomorrow's stage. It's another long one. Bobby, talk me through it.
It's going to be a doozy. There's no doubt about it. 215 kilometers, starting Binche and going to Esperey. So you're actually starting in Belgium and going to France. I think it's going to be, you know, pretty fast start because, you know, after a team time trial, you know, you're not spending 5 or 6 hours on your bike. So you're going to have guys pretty motivated to get into the breakaway. But there is a major sting at the end of this puppy. There's some major sting at the tail of this stage. So taking into account, you know, you always have to think about the sprints nowadays, right? Like that one sprint, which is at 102K. So I believe it's going to be a fast start. I don't think the first break will go right away. I think it'll take a while, but one will be established. We'll see how many guys get off because I do think that, you know, that competition for the green jersey, it's not like you just want to give those points away and let, you know, 15 guys go up the road. But it's definitely going to light up there at the end because you have a Cat 4 at 173K, a Cat 3 at 185.5, another Cat 3 at 190, and yet another Cat 3 at 199. So,
and then it looks like it's a little bit of an uphill finish as well, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So
there's some snacks there at the end.
Yes, plenty of snacks. But it's also going to make it for a very, very stressful finale. When the tour comes back into France, you know it's going to be a lot of people on the road. You know the French riders are going to be uber motivated. And what happens with stress? Crashes. So in these situations, those teams that are protecting their GC leader are going to have a very stressful end of that race. That last 20K, last 30K, last 40K, it's going to just start ratcheting up, getting more and more dangerous. We're going to be seeing more and more guys on the side of the road. Hopefully not. But yeah, it's, you know, 4K neutral, and then it's going to be
unlike Donkey Kong.
Balls to the wall from the start, and then, you know, hopefully it'll settle down. But I expect some big fireworks there at the end, and it's all going to depend on positioning, how strong your team is. There is a right-hand turn, like I studied the finish a little bit, and there's a right-hand turn with about 400 meters to go, and then another left-hand turn with just over 250 meters to go. So the run into the finish from 4K to 2K is pretty downhill. Then you have about a K and a half-ish of flat roads, and then there's 500 meters slight uphill. So with that slight uphill after the descent, with those two kind of tricky turns that are going to definitely file things out, I think I'm picking Caleb Ewan tomorrow. He had the legs to win yesterday. He just picked the wrong line, got boxed in, almost was able to step out and still come around those guys. But yeah, when you scrub off even 2K an hour going uphill against Sagan and Tunis, and you're toast. But tomorrow, Caleb Ewan's my man. What do you think?
That's a good pick, actually. I forgot about him. Yeah, I picked Walt van Aert. I think, you know, he won a couple of stages at the Dauphiné. It's a hilly finish. It's going to be hard. It's long. So I'm going with Vanna for this one.
That's not a bad the way they're going. I wouldn't root against them. And in France, you always say jamais deux sans trois, which means never two without three. So yeah, that's a pretty solid pick you got there, Gus.
And never two without three. We'll be back tomorrow with our third episode. That about wraps it up, I reckon. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to PYSO, Put Your Socks on SoundCloud. Follow us on Twitter. Yeah, thank you very much, guys. Until tomorrow, Bobby.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. See you tomorrow.
Inspired by the fabled jerseys of the Tour, Road ID has rolled out a limited edition Tour de France wrist ID. Unlike any other IDs in their lineup, this incredibly sexy ID comes with four interchangeable bands, yellow, polka dot, green, and white. This is a $50 value available in limited quantities for only $34.99. Head on over to roadid.com/TDF to get yours before they run out.
Socks on.